John's Church on the Malone Road in Belfast. It's led by the Reverend Bert Tosh. Culottes are back, apparently. We'll find out how and indeed why to wear them in Woman's Hour in 15 minutes. But now, on Radio 4 FM, we begin a new book of the week. Hopeful, the autobiography, is written and read by the British-born Iranian comedian and actor Omid Jalili. His memoirs reflect on how his unconventional life has led him kicking and screaming into a career in stand-up comedy. Today, he looks at two moments from his life when he's provoked laughter for all the wrong reasons.
Bearcat Comedy Club, Twickenham, 9th of March, 1996. It sounds like it should possess an edgy glamour, but in reality, the Bearcat is a scout hut in Witten. I was one of two open spots performing that night. The other was an extremely good-looking half-Indian bloke. I'd done the Edinburgh Festival the summer before, and fuelled by an alarming off-the-Richter-scale supply of self-belief, I wrote to all the comedy clubs in London listed in Time Out. "Hello, my name is Omid. You might have heard of me as the short, fat kebab shop owner's son, having just stormed the Edinburgh Festival. I'm writing to say I would be willing to come to your comedy club establishment to perform comedy. I can offer a 1 hour, a 45-minute, or a 25-minute set. Finance negotiable. Get back to me ASAP." Several weeks later, nothing. Then a lone phone call from a bloke called Graham. "Hello, is that kebab?" "Yes." "Got your letter. Come down and do 5. If you're good, you can come back and do a paid 10. If you're not, try again next year." I arrived at a dark and smoky function room connected to the Turk's Head pub and was greeted by Graham, a tall man with an impressive moustache, who ushered me towards a backstage area. With no door, it provided the audience with candid scenes of performers preparing to go on stage. Already weird. There I was welcomed by James, another tall man who ran the club with Graham. On this auspicious occasion, James introduced me with a sense of wry mystery. "And now, something from Iran." Remarkably, my 5 minutes went down well. I had a few crowd-pleasing gags, which I felt a little ashamed about. Gags like, "My name is Omid Abu Abdul Qasim Ittihad Ibrahim Mamdouh, but please, just call me Trevor." But my shame lessened having followed the half-Indian bloke whose disastrous 5 minutes included repeating the line, "Trust me, I'm a doctor," his signature catchphrase to general apathy and bemusement. His set ended in chants of "off, off, off." After the gig, I learned that he'd been doing comedy for 3 years and insisted positively that this gig had been quite good, actually. I was surprised to find out that he also worked as a promoter, and even more surprised when he promptly offered me £50 to come to Wimbledon to do his comedy night. This is on top of getting booked for a further 10-minute slot at the Bearcat. The ball was well and truly rolling. The next week, I turned up at the venue in Wimbledon. I'd been worrying excessively about how to begin my act, having listened to bootleg tapes of Lenny Bruce. I'd somehow convinced myself that I had to replace funny with important issues and social commentary. I'd practiced in front of the mirror, speaking first in a droll and funny way, and then shouting ideas cultivated to challenge preconceptions. I had my heart set on an opening about mad cow disease, which had featured heavily in the news that day. I was armed and ready. As I waited anxiously backstage, I observed the act before me. A comic performing alternative ventriloquism, i.e. purposefully low-level and appalling. The sync of the man's speech with his puppet was all wrong, like a badly dubbed Chinese kung fu movie, and it was getting big laughs. He even had a finale that involved drinking beer and trying to talk at the same time. Clearly unable to achieve this proficiently, his puppet opened its mouth, and all the audience could hear were noises of the comedian garbling into his pint glass. Mind-bogglingly raucous laughter ensued. I knew I had to be on top of my game to follow that. I'd already decided that when I was introduced, I would come bounding ironically onto the stage like a Shakespearean actor. Unfortunately, the introduction I received was less than inspiring. "Please will you welcome Omar Darjeeling." I pranced onto the stage regardless, hoping to fill the space with the most expansive presence I could muster. Unaware of the location of the recent beer spillage, I headed nimbly straight into the puddle, slipped, and fell hard. For a moment, it seemed that my body was flying horizontally mid-air. The audience hooted with delight. As I picked myself up and clambered to the microphone, still trying to figure out what had happened. I realised the microphone was firmly attached to its stand and refused to budge. As I struggled to pull it out, the audience started to titter again. A slow but steady comedy instinct pulsed within me and told me to keep up the physical struggling, as it seemed to be getting laughs. At one point, it must have looked like I was wrestling with the microphone stand, as the mic stubbornly resisted my attempts to remove it from its base. When it finally popped out, it banged into my head with such force that a 3-inch cut appeared across my brow. I shouted, "Ow!" in genuine pain. But this time, the audience were clapping. Trying to soldier on from this series of unfortunate events, I started speaking, but realised that I was barely audible. I'd pulled the mic so hard that the cord had disconnected. My formal opening pleasantries were met with obscene heckles. As I looked down, I took a step forward to pick up the cord, but didn't register how close I was to the edge of the stage. I fell headfirst off the platform. I remember looking up at the ceiling from the floor and noticing the pretty wooden panels under the roof. In a brief, snatched moment of relaxation, I marvelled at how the reflected beams from the theatre lights gave the place an almost gothic aesthetic. I even wondered if Dracula's castle in Transylvania looked a bit like that. I slowly came to and was helped back up by punters who were telling me, "It's brilliant, mate. You can't stop now. Keep going." I tried to pull myself up swiftly, but realised the stage was rather too high for me to do anything with elegance, let alone athleticism. That ship had sailed. I was left with no choice other than to heave my leg up and, stomach first, walrus back into the spotlight. Sadly, as I lifted my leg, I stretched a little too ambitiously and my black trousers ripped on cue, revealing a patch of bright white underwear. Again, the audience laughed and clapped their appreciation. As I shuffled, chest first, onto the stage, my grey shirt soaked up all the remaining spilled beer. I slowly rose and gathered myself before my audience. I was sweaty, concussed, wet-shirted, and bleeding heavily from a large vertical cut on my forehead, but still determined to complete my 5-minute set. Catching my breath, I waited for the noise to die down and simply said, in all sincerity, as no one could have predicted this particular sequence of disasters, "Sorry, can I start again?" St. Mary Abbott's Church of England Infant School, Kensington, 1971, show and tell. A teacher, in a stylish pink trouser suit, stood at the front of a small hall with two coconut shells, one in each hand. I was 6 years old, sitting on the floor in the back row. Most days, I wore a white polo neck jumper and sported wild, untamed curls. My eyes were already shadowed with dark circles due to excess TV and anxious preoccupations regarding life on other planets. Miss Staples was in her late 20s and possessed that mix of cuteness and respectability that seems to be characteristic of so many primary school teachers. I remember her showing us these strange objects and not recognising them, my mind began to wander. Perhaps Miss Staples might go shopping later. Or meet her fiancé. He was a man called Steve, who sometimes collected her from school in his Morris Minor. He wore heavy sideburns and had feathery hair like David Cassidy. I once saw them in Kensington Gardens, pouring cups of tea from a tartan-patterned flask and sharing an apple, passing it back and forth between them and taking turns to bite. On another occasion, I saw them holding hands outside a newsagent. It was electrifying. But back to the strange objects, and Miss Staples was asking, "Does anyone know what these are?" A few swotty types raised their hands. "Coconuts! Yes, well done. Lovely, aren't they?" The children who knew went, "Mmm." Now, I knew about apples, oranges, and bananas. I even knew about pomegranates because I was Iranian. I'd never heard the word coconut. I wondered if I'd ever get the chance to taste one. I listened intently. "These are coconut shells. Do you know what sound they make if you bang them together?" A hushed silence fell in the hall. It was a good question. She asked again, "There must be someone who knows." There wasn't. "Well, if you hit the shells together gently, it makes a clopping sound, like a horse trotting. Can you hear it? The assemblage looked on in amazement. Some children looked startled and twisted around to see if Black Beauty had appeared. Does anyone want to come up and have a go? I shot my arm up immediately. Miss Staples looked around the room to see who was capable. She pointed at a girl in the front row. Ruth Stevens. I was gutted. But I understood why Ruth was chosen. All she ever did at break times was pretend to be a horse. Her commitment to horses was not in question. Ruth took the coconut shells, banged them in a rather perfunctory manner, but received a well-deserved round of applause. Well done, Ruth. Anyone else like to have a go? I threw my hand up, whispering passionately, please, please. But this time, she chose a boy with glasses who didn't even look like he cared. He banged the coconut shells, but with very little heart, in my opinion, and also received encouraging applause and a beaming smile from Miss Staples. This felt wholly undeserved, and my stomach churned in the face of this injustice. We might have time for one more. My arm went up. This time, I decided to make eye contact with Miss Staples, trying to fix her gaze and show sincerity by impressing her with my cool and silent dignity. Anyone else?
Me!
I screamed from the back.
Me, please!
Okay, Omid, you can come and have a go, seeing as you seem to really want to. I remember wincing at this remark, knowing that it was slightly sarcastic and disrespectful. I let it go. As a six-year-old, I'd learned to develop a thick skin in order to avoid chronic emotional breakdown. Besides, I was easily pleased. I was going to bang the shells in front of everyone and couldn't wait. I tried to conceal my irrepressible excitement, but I could feel my face heat up as I walked past all the children on the floor and took centre stage. Here you are. She handed over the shells, and I received them ceremoniously. I looked at the crowd, savouring the moment. I clopped the shells together and waited for the applause. My applause. But instead of applause, a roar came from my classmates. Laughter. I was horrified. Huge peals of laughter, children falling backwards and pointing. Confused, I looked up at Miss Staples for validation, for reassurance, but even she seemed to be restraining herself from laughing. I had no idea what had just happened. I sat back down, humiliated. I felt like an alien. Worse, I thought I'd done something terribly wrong. Why did the others get applause, but everyone laughed at me? Had I misunderstood what I was supposed to do? Had I missed some crucial nuance that was critical to mastering this simple task? It's strange to think that although I enjoyed being in the spotlight from a young age, I hated laughter as a child. Here it was aimed at me, towards me, and I was crushed. I sat down, hyperventilating, and in a state of complete psychological disarray. I have no memory of what I actually did to provoke such hilarity. Perhaps it was the combination of the off-kilter rhythm of my clopping, the awkward horse movements, or the ecstatic glee on my face that provoked the uproar. It could also be that it was just funny. Sometimes, funny is inexplicable. Sometimes, funny is just funny.
And Omid Jalili will be reading more from his autobiography, Hopeful, at the same time tomorrow morning. It was abridged by Lou Kemp. The producer is Kirsty Williams. Can you be friends with an ex's new partner? And why are so many young women embarrassed to talk about gynecological health? Just some of the questions for this morning's Woman Czar. We'll be joining Jane Garvey after the news. And later, Asma Mir revisits the Honeyford affair, the heated dispute surrounding a Bradford head teacher whose outspoken criticism of multiculturalism caused a national controversy. The lessons of Ray Honeyford at 11 here on BBC Radio 4.
The BBC asks thousands of questions every day. Is rocket science easier than you think? Would we starve without honeybees? And how did so many soldiers survive the trenches? But what if we want to know more? BBC I Wonder asks intriguing questions and reveals thought-provoking answers. As one question is answered, another is raised. The discoveries are endless. BBC I Wonder. Go to bbc.co.uk/iwonder.